Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. Today my guest will be Mariah Whitehead, who is the Pee Dee River Basin and Winyah Bay Project Director for the Nature Conservancy. That's an awfully long title, but it also includes an area of almost a million acres, does it not, Mariah?
It does. It's a large area.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Mariah. I know you and I know your folks, but let our listeners know that your love of nature came from your childhood experiences.
It did. I had the great fortune of growing up on a family farm in the Pee Dee region just outside of Florence. It was the farm and the home that my mom had grown up in. And I really grew up with a childhood outdoors. I had three brothers, so it was a rough and tumble childhood, catching frogs and snakes and riding horses, working in the yard, and just really enjoying lots of time in the great outdoors.
There's a wonderful picture of you in a magazine with a great horned owl sitting on your shoulder. What's that story? Because I think that tells a lot about your mom and dad and how they reared you children.
It does. And, you know, I really have to give all the credit to my mom for things like raising a great horned owl in our kitchen when we were kids. My grandfather had brought a great horned owl home that he had found in the woods when he had been hunting one morning. And it was right after a pretty large storm had blown through. So it looked like this owlet had been blown from its nest, but there were no signs of the nest around. And so we took the orphaned owl in and fed it chicken gizzards wrapped up with feathers in a playpen in our kitchen in my parents' home.
Was it a full-size owl when it came in?
It was not. It was a ball of feathers. It was a relatively small owlet, but it grew into a large, healthy, great horned owl. We eventually moved it outside into our screened-in sandbox, where we trained it on live mice, and eventually we released the owl back into the wild.
Owls have these huge talons, and here I'm seeing it looks like Mariah Whitehead at maybe five or six with this owl perched on your shoulder.
It was incredible. The owl was very gentle with us and would actually perch on our shoulders, would perch on my mom's head. After we released the owl, my mom could actually call it back. She would cut up some chicken gizzards and go outside. We named it Solomon the Great Horned Owl, and she would call, "Solly!" And here this huge owl would come out of the woods and land on my mom's shoulder or arm and let her feed it chicken gizzards.
So how long did this go on? Did he eventually go back into the wild?
It did. Only as long, only for a few months, I think, until Solly found a mate and made its way back into the natural world.
Well, that's an incredible, beautiful story. I'm still trying to imagine Ida Whitehead with a great horned owl perched on her head.
Well, and I have to say, now with training as an ornithologist, I do not encourage this at home. This was back in the 70s, I think, before we knew that taking in live animals might not always be the best for them. And I think our story worked out well. But there are wonderful places now if you find an orphaned animal.
All right, but in those days, if you hadn't taken it in, it probably would have died.
Likely, yeah.
Now, one part of your career, and your career has been incredible since you left Davidson and then you went to Clemson and then worked in Maui. But you were involved with saving raptors at one time, were you not?
That's right. And actually, my experiences at the Birds of Prey Center in Awandaw really were some of my formative early experiences with birds that sort of led me into that realm of science. And I worked with Jim Elliott at the Birds of Prey Center, first as a volunteer. Gosh, soon after the center opened, probably in about 1996 or 1997.
So just after you got out of college.
Just after I got out of college. And then I eventually became staff at the Birds of Prey Center as their director of research. I always made sure and I spent time in the clinic working directly with the injured birds when I was on staff there. But my job was really to help monitor and study raptor populations in the coastal plain of South Carolina.
Define raptors for us, in South Carolina anyway.
They are birds of prey, so birds with tearing beaks and taloned feet that really are hunters out there in the wild, some of our top predators.
Okay. Owls.
Owls.
Hawks. Ospreys.
Exactly. Eagles.
Eagles.
Sure. And the Birds of Prey Center would also take in vultures. And so we didn't want to leave behind. They're a little different as far as birds of prey go, but equally important.
Do vultures eat live? They usually just eat carrion, right?
They do. They do. They generally eat carrion.
Whereas the others do catch, whether it's mice or rabbits or...
Right. But we know that many of our birds of prey that go after live food are not too proud to take a nice, fresh, dead animal as well. Well, and there's one bird of prey we haven't mentioned. It's the one that that I've been able to continue to study for the decade since I worked at the Birds of Prey Center, and that's the swallowtail kite.
Okay.
Kites are probably our most beautiful birds of prey in South Carolina, and they have a unique adaptation where they always feed on the wing. And so they'll catch their prey in the air and actually bring their feet to their mouth and eat while they're flying.
Now, describe the kites to us, because the others I'm very familiar with, but I'm not sure if I saw a kite, I'd know what I was looking
sure.
at.
Sure. We have two kite species, the Mississippi kite and the swallowtail kite. The Mississippi kites are a little more ubiquitous. Both of the birds have about a 4-foot wingspan. The swallowtail kites are striking black and white birds, and they have a forked tail like a swallow. So when you see them, they're absolutely unmistakable. And many folks, rush to the computer to figure out what they've seen the first time they see a swallowtail kite.
Aren't one of those an endangered species?
Yeah. Swallowtail kites are endangered in South Carolina. So state endangered, but not on the federal endangered species list.
Okay. So the raptor experience was what eventually led you going to college and getting a graduate degree?
Well, the raptor experience was right there, kind of in the middle of some of those degrees. I had been to Davidson at that point and studied biology. And as you might imagine, a lot of my counterparts at Davidson had their sights set on the medical field. And there really weren't a whole lot of ecological sort of field courses at Davidson at that time. So my first jobs out of college, one was in Australia. I worked for an organization called the School for Field Studies and actually was the intern in charge of working with students that were interested in doing avian research in the rainforest in Australia. And it was after that that I came and back to Charleston and moved in with my brother, who was in med school at the time, and enrolled in an ornithology class at the College of Charleston because I said, this is it. I found it. Birds are where I want to be. And I started volunteering for the Birds of Prey Center at that point.
Okay. And eventually you got your PhD.
I did. I went on from there and pursued my master's at the University of Georgia and studied an interesting bird called the brown-headed cowbird and went straight into a PhD program at Clemson and actually studied with Drew Lanham there. And I'm guessing you've probably met with Drew at some point.
Yes. Yes. Then you ended up at the Nature Conservancy.
I did.
And you've been there since 2007.
That's right. And, you know, it was a hard decision to leave a really bird-specific job, which is what I was doing at the Birds of Prey Center. But when the position opened up at the Nature Conservancy, and I knew I was going to have the opportunity to continue my work in science and my work with birds, and specifically to continue working to protect habitats, which at that point I understood was the major threat to birds, was loss of native habitats. But I was going to be able to do all this in a place that my family had called home for 200 years. I knew it was going to be the perfect fit.
You've got a lot of territory to cover when we talk about the Pedee River Basin and Winyaw Bay. Winyaw Bay is, 120,000 acres, that part of it?
Sure, yes. It is a a large project area. And the way the Nature Conservancy works is we work within these, what we might refer to as a conservation landscape, places that we think are vitally important to make investments in land protection and conservation. And we have five of those across the state. Four are in the coastal plain, and the Winyah Bay and Petey River Basin project area or conservation area is the northernmost of our coastal plain project areas.
Yeah. Ace Basin is...
Exactly. Yeah. Ace Basin was really the first conservation landscape where we were making significant investments in engaging landowners in private protection.
All right. That's the question that comes up when people start talking about conservation, land conservation. Some folks get real nervous. You're trying to tell me what to do with my property. But let's start with your home place, what your mom and dad did with that 200-year-old family farm in the Black River Swamp.
Absolutely. Well, I am very proud of my parents' decision and really our family's decision to place our family farm into a conservation easement. We worked with Petey Land Trust to accomplish that. I love the tagline that Petey Land Trust has, protecting the past and ensuring the future. They really see that dual role that conservation can play in protecting cultural landscapes and a way of life, and also protecting our natural systems for future generations.
Late Bill Chandler had something to do with that, I think.
He did. He did. He was a wonderful advocate for Petey Land Trust and conservation in general.
So your folks have placed the family farm, been in your family, for your mother's family, for 200 years. Easements. Now, what does that mean?
I am so glad you asked that, because I have come to recognize there really is a lot of misunderstanding about what a conservation easement is. And I think it's interesting that you said, you know, some people do sort of bristle at this idea of, you know, you're going to suggest what I should do with my property. But I heard someone say recently, and I thought it was such an interesting take on the conservation easement as a tool and as an individual expression of what you'd like to see on your property, that it's actually the ultimate expression of private property rights. For someone to place their property in a conservation easement means that they get to say today what they would like the future of that land to be, even after they're gone. So a conservation easement is a legal tool that we can use for landowners to choose some rights that they might like to surrender that's going to affect the future of that property. Rights like the ability to subdivide the property or the ability to mine the property for minerals. In some cases, they might choose to surrender the right to harvest timber in forested wetland areas. All of those rights have values that are tied to them. So a conservation easement allows us to value the land and your bundle of rights as they are today, and then to value the land with the rights that you've surrendered. And in that appraisal process, we look at the difference between those two values, and the difference becomes your conservation easement value.
So that conservation easement value is a tax write-off.
Exactly. So we have both federal and state tax incentives for landowners that are interested in engaging in a conservation easement.
Well, you mentioned a number of rights. I gather there is a list. You don't have to sign off on all of those.
Exactly. The purpose, the intent of the easement, and really the intent of the land trust groups that work with easement donors, is to tailor the easement to the landowner's long-term goals for the property.
Let's just take your family farm. What did your mom and dad sign away?
Well, they limited the number of future home sites that can be on the property and limited the number of times it could be subdivided. And it's really the property is then dedicated to conservation purpose. And so you know that the long-term goals for the property are going to be aligned with these conservation purposes. Easements can also be aligned with working lands. So it can be perfectly compatible for a family farm where they intend to continue farming into the future, or for what we might call a working forest, where a landowner would like to see the property continue to be used to harvest timber. We work with landowners to develop forest management plans, and we would never encourage a landowner to say that they were absolutely going to, you know, make sure there was no future timber harvest on their uplands, and even to say that they would never use herbicides in the future, because we know now from decades of experience that active management, burning, and even sometimes the use of herbicides can be necessary to maintain our natural communities.
And, of course, the landscape of the PD, people marvel about Francis Marion and his men running around the PD, and they talk about the growth that's there now. But originally it was almost very park-like with very tall longleaf pines and a lot of open area. So that's how he could move by horseback so quickly.
Exactly.
Not with the tangle of second growth that's come up.
And, you know, I think it's important to note that putting a property into protection is really only the first step in conserving a property, making sure that we steward that property. You mentioned longleaf pine, actually making sure that we're helping to restore and steward longleaf pine in South Carolina as the native habitat that we saw on our uplands in the coastal plain. We used to have 13 million acres of longleaf in South Carolina and over 92 million in the southeast, and that's been reduced range-wide to about 3 million acres. So,
yeah, and we found out from natural disasters, whether it's ice or hurricane, things like slash pines aren't always the best thing. They may grow fast, but they're not always the best things to be.
Exactly, and there are some soils where really the longleaf pine are going to outperform almost any other pine in our sandy, dry soils.
Oh, yes. The sand hills here in the middle of the state, longleaf will do just fine.
Yep, exactly.
So anyway, let's get on with the whole idea of conservation, because the organization that you work for, the Nature Conservancy, and there are other organizations that partner with you, like the Land Trust Alliance and the PD Land Trust and Ducks Unlimited,
right,
the hunters, who are very interested in preserving the natural habitat. But you've been with the Conservancy now for 8 years, and you've seen it grown, I think, to several hundred thousand acres in your particular area?
That's right. That's right. So it's an interesting thing to look at the way we've invested in land protection across the state. Across South Carolina, about 8% of our entire land mass is in some form of protection. And the Nature Conservancy has actually been involved in protecting over 330,000 acres in South Carolina. We hold about 150 easements across the state. But I often call my project area sort of the Wild West of land protection. You know, we see some coastal counties like Charleston with 30% of the land in a protected status. And up in the Winyabe River Basin, the total protected status is closer to 10%. There's still plenty of work to be done on that front. And really, a lot of the opportunity there is engaging with some of our former industrial forest lands. So much of the land up in the landscape was formerly owned by International Paper or MeadWestvaco. We've got hundreds of thousands of acres in these industrial forest lands that, you know, really are a large part of the land base that we might be able to work with.
Well, aren't those companies beginning to divest themselves of their tree farms?
Exactly, exactly. So a lot of those companies have divested. We've seen a lot of change in ownership over the last few years. And often, if they see an opportunity for an out sale for real estate, if they see that the land might hold high real estate value, a lot of those lands are being sold off to different interests.
There's one success story that has been highlighted by the Nature Conservancy, and that's Magnificent Mansfield. So you want to tell us about the Parkers and Magnificent Mansfield?
Absolutely. It's maybe one of my favorite projects I've had the opportunity to to work on, because the goals of our organization and the Parker family were so aligned, and I really did learn a lot by working with the Parkers on this particular project. You know, this was not a project where the Nature Conservancy went and knocked on the door of the Parkers and said, you know, we really think you guys should consider a conservation easement. The Parkers knew about easements as a tool for protecting property and had been considering it, as my dad did, for years. Mm-hmm. And it's a big decision, and often it takes a landowner a little while to arrive at the decision that it is indeed time to move forward. So I got the call from Mr. Parker saying, you know, I've decided that 2013 is the year to protect Mighty Mansfield, and I'm talking to some different groups about how to do that. So I had the opportunity to sit down and talk with John Parker about the history of Mansfield, which I think might be one of the most fascinating histories of ownership that I've ever heard.
Well, let's talk about that. Share that.
Yeah. Well, John Parker's ancestor, Susanna Mann, actually was a widowed woman in 1755, and she purchased a little over 500 acres along the banks of the Black River in Georgetown County.
Let me just add a historical note here, because people might say, we didn't think women could do that in the 18th century, that only men. But she was a widow, which meant that she had the legal right to purchase property and so forth. If she had been married, her husband would have been involved. If she were widowed, if she's single, or if she were in business and married, she could get a document filed with the court that she was a femme sole, which meant that she could then buy goods and trade and what have you. But that was, she had to get that legally. Her husband had to sign off on that.
Wow. So fascinating.
But Miss Mann was...
Miss Mann became a very successful rice planter. And Mansfield actually grew under her ownership to over 700 acres. The property stayed in rice cultivation, and at that time, as you know, Georgetown became just a booming center for rice production. Mm-hmm. And there are fascinating stories about the Parkers' ancestors' history with rice. One of the family members was trained as a physician but decided to become a planter instead and apply his scientific mind to the planting and cultivation of rice, and he started experimenting with different fertilizers and actually figured out that bat dung was one of the best fertilizers out there and was able to increase his crop yields way above his other neighbors in the Plantersville district. Mansfield was one of about 25 rice plantations, and as you know, it was just perfectly situated in this tidal zone of the Winyah Bay River Basin, where the push and the pull of the tide was there daily to supply the rice fields with the water they needed. But it was the fresh water moving up and back. The salt wedge really wasn't reaching these areas where the planters were cultivating rice. The plantation stayed in rice cultivation even up to the time of the Civil War. In the late 1800s, there were a series of devastating storms that hit the Georgetown area. And between 1880, I think, is that right, Walter? And the early 1900s, several of these storms had really caused the demise of the...
Yes, people think about the great hurricane of 93, which is 1893, which the Beaufort area. But as George Rogers in his History of Georgetown County chronicles, Georgetown was the rice production center of the state, and the storms in the last two decades of the 19th century pretty much ended it. A few struggled on, and I think Mansfield actually did struggle into the 20th century.
It struggled on and eventually looked to the uplands to create some income. The large longleaf pine that was there was harvested. You know, they really did what they could to hold on to the property and keep it in the family. But in, I believe, 1912, they finally decided to sell Mansfield, and they sold it to a northern family that was buying it as a recreational property.
Which happened to, I think, almost the majority of the plantations in Georgetown County were sold as hunting lodges to rich folks from up north.
Exactly. There could be a book on how northern industrialists saved the South.
Right? Well, actually, there are some folks who have written on that. And, of course, if they were interested in hunting, they're right in the Atlantic Flyway
exactly.
for ducks.
So it became all the fad to have one of these duck plantations. And those rice fields and the incredible ingenuity that was applied to actually creating those then became, you know, a central infrastructure for managing waterfowl impoundments.
And then that lasted for about 50 or 60 years. And then those families lost interest, began to sell off.
Exactly.
People don't realize that, for example, it's not in Georgia, but the Dodge family for years had a place in South Carolina, actually down at Edisto. Mm. But you could mention the industrial magnates of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and a lot of them had a place in South Carolina yep. on the coast. So Mansfield's no longer going to be a hunting lodge. How do the Parkers get back in control?
Well, it eventually sold back into a South Carolina family. Another family, the Montgomerys, owned it after the Tuttles, and then there was one more ownership after the Montgomerys. And then in 2004, Mansfield came up on the market. And at that time, John Parker, I believe, had vowed if he had ever had the opportunity to purchase Mansfield and bring it back into the family, that he would do everything in his power to do that. And that opportunity came, and he made it happen. So in 2004, he and Sally purchased Mansfield, and it had been out of the family for 92 years.
So it's back in the family, and do they live there?
They actually, at that point, Mansfield had become a bed and breakfast. And so they decided to continue the bed and breakfast business. They have a home there, but they also have a home and a business in Asheville. So they successfully split their time between Asheville and Mansfield and beat the road back and forth, I think, at least a few times a month.
Well, that's not an easy direct commute.
Exactly.
Just getting to Georgetown from Columbia is not an easy
right.
commute. So how many acres are we talking about now have they assembled?
The easement is over 800 acres. So all of the historic plantation is within the conservation easement. And they have some additional acreage that is not yet within the conservation easement. But well over 800 acres are in the easement.
I think that's when you talked about, because the historic plantation was 700 acres
exactly.
that the widow man was able to put together. So that really you've got 2 centuries plus actually working on 250 years.
Right, right, right.
And are the abandoned rice fields still there?
They are. The rice fields are still there, and the rice fields are one of many things that the Parkers have invested in, restoring and maintaining over the years. So they've maintained those historic dikes and trunks that allow them to continue to use the rice fields as they had been in the past. They are not cultivating rice, but they can cultivate waterfowl to some extent. And really that we see that across the board in Mansfield. The Parkers are as committed to restoring the historic structures on site as they are the natural communities. And they're actively engaged in restoring a historic slave village on site and also restoring longleaf pine.
I think part of that, the slave street, would have been a chapel, which I think that's already been restored.
That's right. The chapel is beautiful. And I did, when I was out there working on the baseline report, one of my coworkers and I walked into the chapel as part of the process of documenting all the structures on the property. And it is a spiritual place. It is absolutely beautiful what they've done with the chapel. And what I find really unique about the Parkers' approach, they've placed the slave village about 15 acres around the village into a foundation, trust. And so the Parker Family Foundation leases that space. And so they are actively working to acquire the funds through the foundation to do a full restoration. The foundation board includes two descendants of enslaved African Americans that lived on Mansfield that are helping to direct that project and make those investments. I've felt through this experience of protecting Mansfield, it was one of the most significant experiences I've had in recognizing the role that conservation can play in protecting our cultural resources and our history.
Mariah, we need to pause for a moment and let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Mariah Whitehead of the Nature Conservancy.